Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden. On the evening of Thursday, August 29th, 2013, as tensions heightened about possible U.S. military involvement in Syria, Chicago Area Peace Action organized a panel presentation entitled "Our Democracy in Crisis: The Rise of the Total Surveillance State and the War on a Free Press." The event was held at Anderson Chapel at North Park University on Chicago's North Side and featured four speakers on politics, media, and the current political scene. The first speaker is Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild and author of the book Spying on Democracy.
It's a pleasure to be in Chicago. In 1971, when the FBI formally ended its counterintelligence programs, J. Edgar Hoover kept open the possibility of continuing them, calling the programs a success. Revelations of covert spying, made then as now by concerned citizens, resulted in the Church Committee investigating government intelligence activities and instituting what were significant reforms to curb spying and surveillance on Americans. Limits were placed on FBI spying. FISA courts were established to prevent a recurrence of Nixon's warrantless wiretapping, which had actually dated back to the 1920s when the government first developed audio technology that enabled it to spy on Americans. Even then, during the Church Committee hearings, Idaho Democrat Frank Church, chairman of the committee, found that every presidential administration, whether it be Republican or Democratic, had abused their power. He warned, quote, "The NSA's capability at any time could be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy at all. If a dictator ever took over," he said, "the NSA would enable it to impose total tyranny, and there would be no way to fight back." Nearly four decades later, we don't have a tyrant in power, we don't have a dictator, but a confluence of factors have really threatened our privacy and constitutional protections. They include massive U.S. national defense spending, a powerful and virtually unchecked executive branch, a codependent corporate government intelligence state sustained by a perpetual war on terror. Any campaign of perpetual war, as James Madison cautioned, makes it impossible for any nation to preserve its fundamental freedoms. So how did we arrive at this state? After the Cold War, the military establishment underwent a steady decrease in spending, reaching in the 1990s its nadir. The events of 9/11 permitted the U.S. to recoalesce and reinvigorate military spending. This merging of sophisticated technology, much of it designed specifically for data aggregation and surveillance, and billions of dollars for military spending in the name of securing our national security, animated the current surveillance state. The blurring of lines between what many understand to be traditional government functions with the attendant oversight and accountability that we rely on is due to an increasing sharing of information and duties between government and the private sector. The past half a century has witnessed an expansion of the executive branch of government, really dwarfing the legislative and judiciary branches. With what some call a unitary executive, we've come to see unparalleled secrecy, with punishment for members of the media whose investigative reporting sheds light on illegal or ineffective government and corporate policies. Under this shroud of secrecy, the close partnership between business and government has flourished, at times rendering the distinction between them virtually nil. On the few occasions when programs of wide-ranging surveillance gathering on ordinary Americans have been made public, there has been public outrage and some congressional action. For example, in 2002, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, conceived the Total Information Awareness Program. It created massive computer databases to collect information on everyone in the United States, from our emails to medical records to social networks, to analyze suspicious activities and connections between other individuals. For public relations reasons, the program's name was later changed to Terrorism Information Awareness to emphasize that it wasn't created to keep dossiers on all of us. A year later, after public outcry, Total Information Awareness was defunded by Congress. But despite its defunding, the basic structure of the program survived and was transferred to other intelligence agencies. However, perhaps one of the most important lessons learned that informs the current state of affairs, don't tell Congress if you want to keep something secret. The revolving door between government, intelligence officials, and the corporate defense industry ensures that both partners in this mass surveillance benefit, while we, the public at large, lose our privacy and our constitutional protections. 80% of the 108 three- and four-star generals and admirals who retired between 2004 and 2008 took jobs with defense contractors or consultants. In some cases, they continued to advise the Department of Defense, raising serious questions of potential bias and conflict of interest in how this work is carried out. In 2011, the Department of Defense paid nearly $100 billion to the five largest defense contractors, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Boeing, and Northrop Grumman, and took at least nine of the top-level generals and admirals who recently retired took positions with those companies. So it's not surprising that the defense industry actively seeks out lobbyists with backgrounds in appropriations and with strong connections to the Hill. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington issued a report in late 2012 documenting in detail this revolving door between the Pentagon and private security. In becoming beholden to corporations to conduct our national security and intelligence, we forfeit the hallmarks of good government, namely oversight, quality control, transparency, and ultimately our own national security. A few other indicators of how virtual government and business have become in performing government functions include the fact that 70% of our intelligence is conducted by private sector contractors. Nearly 2,000 private security firms and 1,200 government organizations, according to a well-known Washington Post investigation, were engaged in the business of surveillance and counterterrorism. Facebook's former security chief, Max Kelly, left Facebook in 2010 for a job at NSA in 2010. And according to the New York Times, federal government intelligence agencies recruit technology experts, invest in Silicon Valley startups, and award classified contracts to avail themselves of the latest software technology to handle large quantities of data. Many of you know that Amazon was awarded $600 million in a CIA computer cloud contract, and that Amazon's CEO just purchased the Washington Post. With no end in sight for a perpetual war, the White House shows little sign of curbing this massive surveillance machinery. The quest for global information on an unparalleled level is designed to secure U.S. domination through total information control. At the same time, all human communications are being collected with the capacity to store them indefinitely being developed by these large private corporations. For Americans who say that if they have nothing to hide, there's no reason to object to pervasive surveillance, they would do well to reread the Bill of Rights and to recall how unbridled power in the hands of an elite few, be it the king or the president, may be used to oppress the people. Now that information can be stored, it can be accessed in the future to look for retroactive infractions. And of grave concern is the fact that our personal information, when stored, may be tampered with to change any number of details about our life history, from health records to employment or academic history, criminal records, financial transactions. Right now, there is no way to correct inaccurate data amassed on us by data aggregators and the government agencies. Several government agencies admit they contain vast amounts of inaccurate data on all of us. And anyone who says they have nothing to hide needs to look back over his or her life and think of an incident you've kept private. While for many, social media has transformed traditional notions of privacy, many more are probably not aware of the repercussions of having nothing we do, of having everything we do, rather, under the watchful eye of government and corporations. Have you ever done something you're now embarrassed about or that you don't want to share with your employer or neighbor? Do you want your boss to know you may see a psychiatrist, are being treated for a medical condition, attend AA meetings, have paid someone under the table, or have a criminal arrest in your background? It's a fact that with untold number of federal and local laws on the books in this country, many of them woefully outdated, if this government wants to target you, it can find something you have done to say you've broken the law, especially now with use of the internet. Judge Alex Kozinski in California has claimed that the average citizen is, quote, probably a federal criminal. Thanks to the criminalization of certain types of otherwise non-threatening behavior, ranging from tax and regulatory infractions to violation of employee codes of conduct. Add violations of online user agreements, and probably everyone in this room has broken the law. Knowing this, anyone who claims to have nothing to hide should reconsider the implications of handing over to the authorities every detail of one's private life. But what should concern us now is that the current surveillance system is patently unconstitutional. Not only does warrantless collection of personal data violate the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but secret government interpretations of sections of the Patriot Act and the FISA Amendment are being used to justify a wholesale infringement of our rights. In a recently declassified document, FISA Judge John Bates wrote that the standards the government uses to search phone record databases for threats were, quote, so frequently and systematically violated that the program has never functioned effectively. We now have a window of opportunity in which to educate ourselves about the many ways we expose our personal information and to decide how we want to conduct our lives and hold our elected officials accountable. If we do not exercise our First Amendment rights to petition the government for a redress of grievances, individually and collectively, we risk further imperiling them. In other words, if our government exceeds the authority granted to it under the Constitution, we the people have a right to formally complain and demand action. And according to our Constitution, the government must respond. Thank you.
That was Heidi Boghossian. The next speaker is Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the recent book, Arguing for Our Lives. Robert Jensen joined the presentation via remote video stream from his home in Austin, Texas.
The scope of this democracy has expanded. People once excluded from full citizenship are now included. Even a formerly enslaved people are now fully enfranchised, albeit everyone acknowledges too slowly. Well, there's much about that standard story that's true, of course, but it leaves out one crucial reality, which is that no matter who votes in elections, powerful unelected forces set the parameters of political action. In other words, voting matters, but it matters far less than most people believe and that many of us want to believe. By unelected, of course, we mean the captains of industry and finance, all of which raises the very impolite question of whether democracy and capitalism are compatible. Is political equality possible amid widening economic inequality? Can power be distributed when wealth is concentrated? These questions are unspeakable in mainstream political circles. Ironically, even though the economic inequality continues to widen and the distorting effects of concentrated wealth are more evident than ever. The limited success of the Occupy movement nudged into view on the margins this, but the impolite question must become even more central in our conversations, raised without sectarian rhetoric and with a clearer analysis of the foundational nature of the problem. Now, let me be clear. I'm not arguing that there's nothing democratic about contemporary America. I'm not suggesting we live in a fascist state. I want to avoid that kind of rhetorical overkill. Rather, I think we need to recognize that, contra the mythology of the United States, no existing nation state is a democracy in any deep sense. And the question is, to what degree are the features of a society, not just the formal political structures, but economic and social realities as well, to what degree are they democratic? And formulating that question that way, I think, opens up the discussion of these difficult realities. Now, moving on to the question of who we mean by us, I think that we have too long believed that the population of the United States is more left than it is, or at least more left as I want to define the term. Conservatives have long insisted this is really a center-right country, and progressives have countered that with various polls that suggest there's popular support for policies that are to the left of center, such as national health insurance. But whatever the outcome of that debate, here's what I think we need to acknowledge. That if by left we mean a consistent critique of the domination-subordination dynamic that structures life in the United States, the left, by that definition, is essentially invisible in contemporary politics. Such a left would be anti-capitalist and critical of U.S. imperial adventures abroad. Such a left would take seriously the deeply embedded white supremacist nature of U.S. society, and would take seriously the devaluing and exploitation of women that is so deep that its sexual component is now a routine part of pop culture that goes largely unquestioned. And such a left, I think, would also recognize that the high-energy, high-technology industrial system that produces the much sought-after American lifestyle is a kind of a death cult, so profoundly unsustainable that continued allegiance to that lifestyle all but guarantees catastrophic results for coming generations, if not for those of us currently here. So when I describe myself as being on the left, that's what I mean. I don't expect all of my comrades to agree with all the points I just articulated, especially not when we get to the details. But I would expect an acknowledgement that all of those points are coherent and they must be confronted. But I think even within the small left that does exist, that agreement is relatively hard to come by. So, summing up, we don't live in a meaningful democracy, and the vast majority of people don't really care. Now, that is a bit hyperbolic. I actually don't want to be engaging in the rhetorical overkill I mentioned. But I do that consciously in order to make the point that I think we need to come to terms with reality and devise organizing strategies based on that reality, no matter how grim it may be. Expanded surveillance and the suppression of journalism are part of that problem, but in my opinion, we should always be discussing them in this larger context, which I think is far scarier than concerns about the NSA or the state of mass media. Wishful thinking, you know, believing the country is on the verge of turning to progressive or left ideas, is not going to bring left and progressive public policy into being. So I want to offer that not as a challenge to anything that has been said or will be said, but as a kind of reminder to keep in context, even though I think that context is in some ways very depressing. But I'll end with an observation made by one of what I think is the great writers of the last half of the 20th century in the United States, the novelist and activist James Baldwin, who in a 1962 essay pressed this need for a kind of reality-based thinking and organizing. when he said, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." Thank you.
That was Robert Jensen. The next speaker is Robert McChesney, professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and the author of a number of books, including the recent book, Digital Disconnect: How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy.
You know, I think, like Bob Jensen, I would like to say we should step back here and think about, you know, what's the context for what's taking place here and why it's important. And I think when we look at the NSA surveillance scandal and the crisis we face right now with really the elimination of civil liberties that have been known traditionally in the United States in our history, it goes back to two of the great problems at the founding of the Republic that the founders and the framers in their best days were obsessed with when they dealt with the notion of tyranny, when they set up this country. And one of them goes back to the very beginning of the first democratic experiments in ancient Greece, in Athens. And the first one is the incompatibility of having a permanent war economy or an empire with trying to have the rule of law and a democracy and a republic. There's a great deal of tension between the two. And the people who started this country, the framers, and they had their flaws. But one thing they were well aware of was that earlier efforts at self-government in Athens and in Greece and in Rome had collapsed primarily because those countries were military empires that were constantly at war, and you could not sustain a free society, a self-governing society, while you're constantly fighting wars. And James Madison, and what I think might be the single greatest quote ever that you already quoted, so I'm going to quote it again because it's that good. Madison was obsessed with the threat of militarism to having a free society, for not only civil liberties, but for even the whole constitutional system to survive. And he said, "Of all the enemies of liberty, war is the most dreaded, because within war is the germ of every other threat to liberty." And what he meant by that, he went on to expound, was when you have a society that's permanently at war, you have corruption is unavoidable, inequality is unavoidable, secrecy is unavoidable, and propaganda. He used a different term, emoluments, but he meant propaganda to whip up the population to hysterically follow the militaristic path is unavoidable. And so Madison said, if you have a permanent war economy, you cannot have a free society or democracy. Those factors will all come into play. They always accompany militarism. And as he said famously at the end of the passage, no nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. Boy, those are words every American should think really long and hard about, because we have now on 6 decades of being permanently at war. 6 decades of having a military infrastructure that is completely unaccountable, not just to the public, but to Congress. Or as Heidi said, even to the courts. There's just zero accountability for this military national security establishment. It has a life of its own. It's a $1 trillion-plus industry when you put all the costs together, unaccountable to anyone. And we're trying to plant that alongside a free society and a democracy. Madison said that's impossible. History says that's impossible. And we're trying that experiment right now. And I don't like how it's turning out so far. I think we might want to rethink that one. And then one point about this that's really important, and you talked about this a little bit, Heidi, but it's a question I get a lot, too. People say, well, you know, I don't care if their government's spying on everyone. They're trying to find bad guys, and I haven't done anything bad. So if it helps the government find the bad guys, why do us good guys have anything to worry about? And there's a really important reason why the James Madisons of the world and why you should be concerned about that idea that only bad guys need to worry about total surveillance of your activities. The fact of the matter is you can't trust the government. You should never trust any government to have that sort of power. In the historical record, and not just ancient history, but recent history, demonstrates that over and over again. When the government has surveillance power and it's unaccountable, it invariably uses that against people at the bottom of the pecking order who are organizing politically. From World War I with the socialists, the labor movement, the anti-war movement of World War I, my God, we had U.S. senators thrown out of the Senate. We had, you know, mayors thrown out of mayordom. We had people locked up like Gene Debs for just nonviolently opposing the war. This power is invariably abused. In the 1960s with the counterintelligence program, they went after peaceful anti-war protesters, civil rights activists. You know, it's funny, they don't go after the bankers. You know, the bankers run the economy off the off a cliff in 2007. You don't find, gee, the government's been surveilling Goldman Sachs' board meetings to find out how they destroyed the economy. They never go after those guys. They go after Occupy Wall Street. That's the problem. This arbitrary, unaccountable power invariably is used on behalf of the most powerful elements of society. That's the great danger. And so I guess if you pose no threat, if you just are at all whatsoever politically, you have nothing to worry about. But people who want to exercise their constitutional rights have a lot to worry about when you have this sort of unaccountable power. Another point that Heidi raised that I think is worth emphasizing again is that the national security state, the military in our country, they don't operate in a vacuum. They don't operate in isolation. In fact, they're joined at the hip with corporate America. This is an enormous part of our political economy. It's difficult to imagine our political economy without militarism. George W. Bush hasn't said many things that I've quoted favorably in his career as president or governor before that. But one thing he said, he went to Argentina in 2001 or two during the recession in Argentina, and the Argentine president was doing all sorts of radical things then with the economy that George W. Bush didn't approve of. And what George W. Bush said to him, look, what we do in America when we want to ramp up our economy, we just spend more money on the military. That's sort of the way we get growth in our economy. And he spoke a truth there, which is the sort of reliance our capitalist economy has upon militarism for staying the nose above water with growth. That's a dangerous relationship. And what we see is the largest companies in our economy have very close relations with the military, far too close. They both depend on each other. And this is especially troubling when we look at the internet. Right now, we see companies like Google, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, AT&T, Verizon, right on down the list. These companies are all vacuum cleaners of information. You know, there's the great line about the internet. If you get something for free on the internet, you're not the customer, you're the product. And you're the product for these companies. And even the ones you're paying money, like Apple or AT&T or Verizon, they treat it the same way. Everything you do there is their property to use to exploit. And what the record shows, and I documented in detail in Digital Disconnect, these companies have a very close relationship with the National Security Agency, with all the police and security forces and military. It's at a number of levels. It's a very rich and rewarding relationship for these companies. They work very closely together, sharing information. It is a disaster, any way you slice it, for a free society. And let me then turn to a question that Bob Jensen raised, really the existential question about, you know, what sort of democracy do we have in that context? What does this mean for our society that our economy is dominated at this level by companies that work closely with an unaccountable surveillance police state apparatus? And here I'm going to turn, interestingly enough, to an economist named Milton Friedman, a conservative economist who taught about 10 miles south of here at the University of Chicago. And Friedman had a very elegant defense, I think, of why capitalism is the best possible society for free society, for liberty. And Friedman's argument in a book called Capitalism and Freedom, which came out just about 50 years ago, was that only in capitalism is control over the economy separate from control over the government. Under feudalism, the king was the richest guy. He ran the economy, he ran the government. Under communism, the Communist Party owns all the economy and they run the politics. So Friedman said, if you have the same people who run the government who run the economy, if they don't like you, they can make it so you can't survive economically. They can make it so you have no existence in the society. Under capitalism, because economic power and political power are separate, there's room for freedom to prosper. Economic power and political power are separate. There's room for freedom to prosper, and you can have a free society. Well, let's check out Friedman's hypothesis with the evidence we have now. What we see is that instead of having a competitive market that's over here, and a government's over here, and they're sort of two different worlds. Instead, we have a non-competitive market dominated by a handful of companies that economists would call monopolies in the olden days. They have so much market power that have total control over what the government does. They're joined at the hip. That sort of breathing space for freedom has disappeared. It doesn't exist anymore. We have what actually comes far closer, and here I say this not to be pejorative, to the textbook definition of fascism. Large corporations and government working very closely together to advance corporate interests, with the government focusing on surveillance, propaganda, and militarism. That's actually the textbook definition of fascism. And I'm not saying that's where we are, nor was Bob, but I think we have to address the facts when we see the evidence as it lays out as it does. And it does get to the other point that Bob alluded to, which is all the new research that's come out in the last few years by the leading political scientists in America that's been published, and I've been monitoring this for the work I did with John, shows that the research shows that the vast majority of Americans have zero influence over government policy whatsoever. In the sense of democracy being the rule of the people, we do not have a democracy. That's not even a debatable question. If you're going by the classical definition. In fact, the research even shows that representatives in Congress, when they work on policies, are more likely than not to take the opposite position from the poorest third of the people in their district. They will never take that position. They always serve the interests of the very wealthy. The debates that are relevant are between wealthy interests. Those are the political debates of our times. And those interests are the ones who set the terms of the debate. In other words, we've got a serious problem, if it isn't clear. Bob, is that depressing enough so far?
I'm with it.
Good. Now, this is another way to think about the issue of civil liberties it's not normally talked about. Most people look at the issue of surveillance and the loss of our liberties or the right to civil liberties as a matter of you need these liberties in order to have democracy. If you don't have the right to free speech, you don't have freedom of the press, freedom to worship, freedom to assemble like this, then you can't have a democracy. You can still have elections, but they're really going to be bogus, right? But it also works the other way around, and this is where we are. If you don't have a credible democracy, it's very hard for those liberties to survive. If you don't actually have people governing their own countries in a really tangible, meaningful sense, then the liberties that can survive are usually going to be the ones that are unthreatening to people in power or trivial ones. You have the right to have a tattoo on your butt. No one cares about that. But if you're going to criticize people in power over something fundamental like the economy or like militarism, then you're sort of a troublemaker, got to keep an eye on you. And that happens gradually when democracy loses its substance and becomes a formal shell game. And that's really the moment we're in now. And that's why the two are so tied together. Having civil liberties, having freedoms, having those great constitutional rights really can't survive unless you have a credible democracy they're part of. They can't have one without the other. Either way, it's a two-way street. The framers were well aware of this. Madison and Jefferson in particular, they repeatedly discussed this. They were concerned about militarism, obviously, but they also said there's got to be a solution. What can we do to make sure that we don't go the route of Athens or Rome, that we don't become a militarist society with inequality, secrecy, and propaganda dominating? What is the solution? Well, the Fourth Estate, freedom of the press, having a credible independent news media that gives the information to the great mass of the population to prevent the state from veering off in anti-democratic forms. That was it. I mean, if you read them, that's exactly what they talked about, why we had to have a press system. And it's why the federal government in the first 100 years of American history had enormous subsidies to spawn a huge print media that never would have existed without those postal and printing subsidies, because they knew otherwise, left just to the market, a term no one used then, left just to the market, you'd only have news media for rich people. And that you couldn't have a democracy if you just had news media that supported rich people. You had to have a news media that served everyone. So they put in these postal subsidies. They put in these printing subsidies to spawn that. And the first function of this press system had to be to monitor the government in terms of militarism to see that it didn't go off and do about a half-baked wars and become unaccountable. Because Jefferson and Madison knew that this country was, you know, about to take over a continent. They were wise enough to know it would not be a long time till this country was the most powerful country in the world, if not in the world, certainly one of the two or three most powerful. They were sitting in this gold mine continent. They knew that. And they knew that no matter how well-intended elected leaders were, when you get power of something that rich and that vibrant, there's the imperial temptation. And it needs to be closely monitored by a free people to prevent the abuses of militarism and colonialism from taking over in this country. And that was the role of the press. The solution was a free press. And in fact, one of Madison's last lines, shortly before he died, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, so I'm paraphrasing, it's not exact, but he said, "A society without information, quality information, or access to it by the population cannot be a democracy or republic. It's a prelude to a tragedy or a farce or perhaps both." And that bookends his earlier comments about militarism and survival of freedom. You've got to have that information system. And here, in this case of the surveillance scandal, of the NSA crisis, the failure of the press system is of epic, scandalous proportions. This was unquestionably the lowest hanging fruit story in America for the last 10 years. I mean, it was hanging so low it came out in China. You had all these revelations about this going on. When I was doing Digital Disconnect, I was actually just reading the business press and newspapers, and everything that is now considered a revelation was being talked about openly. Yeah, we know everything about everyone. We're keeping all this. Sure, we turn it over to the cops whenever they ask. We don't care. We're making money. They just said all this stuff. It was the lowest hanging fruit ever. But where were the stories in the Washington Post and the New York Times? Where were the stories on NPR? Where were the stories on CNN or MSNBC? With a couple of wonderful exceptions, like a series Dana Priest did in the Washington Post in 2010, they were nowhere to be found. Nowhere to be found. This story was verboten. It was covered the same way the story would have been covered in the Soviet Union in 1955. It was just simply covered like it wasn't a story. You saw the low-hanging fruit, but that's just not something you talk about. Now, why is that? Why is the coverage so dreadfully bad? Part of it was due to the nature of the way professional journalism has devolved in the United States in the last 50 years, so that it basically accurately reports debates between people in power. So it accurately reflects the debates the heads of the Democratic and Republican Party are having. The problem with that wonderful theory of journalism is that if both of them agree on something, like having a secretive spying state and they aren't debating it, there's nothing for journalists to cover. And if a journalist raises the issue, they're considered ideological and unprofessional for talking about something people in power aren't talking about or debating. And that is a wonderful disciplinary effect in keeping journalists in line, not to want to be seen as ideological, unprofessional by covering a story people in power don't consider a legitimate issue. And the second factor, of course, which is unavoidable, that underscores that, is the institutional force, the corporate power that's involved there. That the institutions that dominate and own our news media ultimately are people who are very comfortable with the status quo in America, including the military-industrial complex, and they don't send out the vibes that they really want to challenge this. So ironically, or tragically, but certainly revealingly, it took a nonprofit newspaper from Britain, The Guardian, which is run by family trusts, so they aren't out to satisfy shareholders, they're not owned by billionaires. In Britain, another country that doesn't rely, get its cues from the American upper class on what a legitimate story is, to break this low-hanging fruit story. That says everything one needs to know about how dreadful our journalism is. And the fact that the story has been met, by and large, by journalists basically saying, in America, questioning whether the story should even be covered at all, that this is sort of outrageous that someone would even consider this a news story. So I'll conclude simply by saying that the moral of the story to me, as we look at this great scandal, which is going to be a defining scandal of our lifetimes, and not just people my age, but people my children's age and the age of the students in this room, are two points that we're going to have to deal with that aren't going to go away of their own volition. One, we have to directly address, you know, are we going to be a militarized society forever? I mean, what is the point of this? And this has to become a central issue in our politics, a central issue all candidates are forced to address, all politicians, all people who talk about public life, and we all have to think seriously about. And secondly, we have to deal with the fact that we no longer have a credible news media, we no longer have credible journalism in society, and we have to take steps to make sure we do have it. Because if we don't have it, then the idea that we're thinking we can live anything remotely close to a free society is indeed a tragedy or a farce. Thank you very much.
That was Robert McChesney. The final speaker is John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine and associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin.
There are few honors greater than to be on a panel with someone associated with the National Lawyers Guild. Because the National Lawyers Guild understands something fundamental about our rights and our freedoms, and that is that they are not merely subtleties, they are not merely extractions, they are not merely words put on paper, they exist in a context. And that context is economic. And too many of our legal groupings imagine that our rights are only defined by a world that has no economic reality in it. The National Lawyers Guild, founded in 1910, 37 has said for the better part of 75 years that we are not fully free, we are not fully able to exercise our rights when we are denied economic democracy. The National Lawyers Guild makes real the promise of the American Constitution. Let me begin by saying that I am opposed to going to war in Syria. I am opposed to the United States attacking Syria. I say that openly, clearly, and without apology, as anyone should be able to do in a free and open society. Nothing is more important than the ability of a citizen to speak up with knowledge and with confidence about whether they want their country to go to war, whether they want people to be killed in their name and with their tax dollars. That is an essential element of any democratic society. We formed the United States because British kings were organizing wars with their cousins and then drafting Americans to go and fight them. And we said, no, we would prefer to opt out of that process. If you want to fight your European wars, you go ahead and do it. We're going to form another country here. That's the point of this experiment. When they wrote the Constitution in 1787, George Mason, the essential author, the core components of that, forget McChesney with his James Madison stuff. You know, as we were driving up, I said, I'm going to give you the Madison quote tonight. You're going to own the Madison quote. And then Heidi comes up and grabs it away from him. Yeah, not even going to Madison. George Mason said that the point of the Constitution was clogging rather than facilitating war. That we wrote a Constitution with the purpose. This is in 1787, in the hall, in Philadelphia. We wrote this document with the purpose of making it hard to go to war. In the next few hours or next few days, we will test whether the Constitution is still in effect, whether it still applies. It is possible, and believe me, I hate the modern technology of the phone. Look at this guy, he's checking on his phone right now. And because, you know, are we at war yet? And you know, the fact of the matter is, before we leave this room tonight, we could be at war. It's very, very possible. It's very, very possible before I know that Andrew Card suggested during the Bush administration that you shouldn't roll out new wars in August, but it is highly possible that we will roll out a new war before Labor Day. I don't speak about this casually. This is the reality of the moment in which we live. We may well be at war within hours. And the great test of our Constitution will be whether that war is declared. And I will suggest to you that there is a very real possibility that people in Syria may well die in short order in a war that was not declared by the United States Congress. That is a violation of the Constitution of the United States. That is a dismissal of the Constitution of the United States if we attack Syria without a congressional declaration of war. But you understand that we have not declared war in this country since 1941. The last time we formally declared war was 1941. And, you know, every president since has had an excuse. Oh, you know, UN resolution, Gulf of Tonkin resolution. I felt like it. And again and again and again, we have gone into undeclared war. We may well do so again before we leave this room tonight. And you have to ask yourself, how did we get here? How did we get to a place where this country can go casually into undeclared war without an open debate, without a congressional declaration, without following the basic premises of the Constitution of the United States? How did we get here? Now, it isn't necessity. Let me emphasize to you, it is absolutely not necessity. Because when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941, killing thousands of people on American soil, Franklin Roosevelt's first action was not to send a cruise missile into Damascus. His first action was to call a joint session of the United States Congress and to go before it humbly as the President of the United States and ask for a formal declaration of war, because he could not wage war as the president. That was unconstitutional. And when you have been attacked, when you have the threat of additional attacks, and yet you go before the Congress to ask for that declaration, it will tell you it is not necessity that has caused us to dismiss our Constitution. Rather, it is opportunity. And the fact of the matter is that Mason was right. A constitution, laws, an open and free discourse clogs rather than facilitates the rush to war. Every war up until World War II, we had immense debates in this country about. One of the great lies, and Robert's a young man, McChesney's pretty old, and so McChesney's one of these guys that remembers the 60s and thought something important happened then. I like the 60s. There's many rock albums that are adorable. But the fact of the matter is the anti-war movement of the 1960s was not the greatest anti-war movement in American history. The anti-Civil War movement was far more ambitious, perhaps not more noble. The anti-World War I movement was incredible and amazing. But the most incredible war movement of all was in the War of 1812. We were literally occupied. The British Army was firing on the Capitol in Washington, and in 1814, the United States Senate held a debate on whether to defund the war as the missiles were being fired at the Capitol, because the Constitution requires that all wars be revisited within 2 years, that you cannot keep a perpetual war going. So they had the debate, and maintaining the war won by 2 votes. I'm not kidding. It was a substantial number of senators who said, we're ready to make peace with the British. We don't want to do this anymore. So the fact of the matter is that all this notion of necessity of action, no, we've had great debates always in this country. But something happened in World War I. In World War I, it became clear that huge numbers of Americans did not want that war. And it also became clear that huge numbers of Americans realized that that war was highly profitable, that munitions merchants were making a fortune. George Norris, the senator from Nebraska, said, "I fear we are about to attach the dollar sign to the American flag, that we are going to go overseas waging wars not for American values or American ideals, or certainly not for the safety and good of America, but rather for the profits of multinational corporations." That is not some modern statement made by Noam Chomsky. That is George Norris in 1917. The fear of this dialogue about why we might really be going to war caused an incredible crackdown. As Bob noted, editors were put in jail. Members of Congress were removed. Victor Berger, the socialist leader from Milwaukee, was elected to the Congress of the United States as an anti-war candidate, as an opponent of the munitions industries, and the Congress refused to seat him. He was sent back to Milwaukee. He ran again, Milwaukee elected again. The Congress refused to seat him, an elected member of Congress, because he dared to raise the issue. And the crackdown, you understand, where did our security state come from? Well, its roots are deep, no doubt of that. But if you go back and you look at 1917, 1918, 1919, what was done in this country to crack down on dissent, to assault a free press, and to begin a surveillance state that punished those who spoke up, that sent immigrants back to the countries from which they came, that jailed presidential candidates like Eugene Victor Debs, that shut down newspapers and magazines, that spied on the American people. You find it there, ironically, at that moment when the dialogue about why we went to war suddenly became real. And I would argue tonight, as we try to wrestle with all of these issues, that the most important thing to understand is that the loss of a free press is not relevant to the press. The freedom of the press protection was not, and I'm a journalist, I rode my bike down Main Street in Union Grove at the age of 11 to start writing for the weekly newspaper. I have done this all my life, but I know the freedom of the press protection has nothing to do with me. That's a lie that has been fostered in the years recent years. The freedom of the press protection exists for you. The freedom of the press protection exists so that you get the information you need to govern your own affairs. And at no point is that information more important, more vital, than on the eve of war. When we contract, when we undermine, when we delegitimize, when we make irrelevant the press of this country, we facilitate rather than clog the rush to war. Our diminished press is a vehicle by which war is made easy. And it's summed up, you can go into great details here if you want about the economics of the press, how much a diminished and undermined and broke press. You live in Chicago, your Chicago Tribune is always for sale. Not on the street, but to whoever, whatever billionaire might want it. But that diminished press is wonderful for a status quo. It is wonderful for power. But the situation of our press is summed up best by George Bush. No greater philosopher ever to sit in the White House. Not the old guy, the young George Bush. He was interviewed before or during the Iraq War by an Irish reporter, a woman who had been set up. He was going to Ireland, and so he had to do one interview with an Irish reporter. So the greatest reporter in Ireland sat down with him, and she started asking him questions about what U.S. munitions were going through military bases and how the military bases in Ireland and the airports in Ireland were being used, specific questions about the circumstance of her country and the relationship with the U.S., totally legitimate questions. And he answered it with a completely different statement, something irrelevant to it. And she said, "Mr. President, you're not answering my question." And he again went off on a wholly different tangent, did not begin to answer it. She said, "Excuse me, Mr. President, you're not answering my question." George Bush looked at her and he said, "I don't know how you do it in Ireland, but we don't do it this way in America. I say what I want to say. I define the interview." He didn't actually go into that detail, but this is actually the truth. He shut her down. He said, "No, you don't ask us tough questions. That's not how it works." Woman was dismissed. And believe me, I wish it was just Bush. That is how our power in this country operates. So when we diminish the press, we facilitate rather than clog war. And when we spy on Americans, again, the lie, the fantasy, is that spying on Americans is about knowing what you're doing. It's not. You're not that interesting. Well, that woman is, but most people here are not that interesting. I'm sorry. Heidi, you go to that. Have you ever done anything embarrassing? These people haven't. They've been out trying to achieve peace and justice. It's very unembarrassing people. No. The government spies on you to know how to manipulate you. That's the point of gathering information. You don't gather information from the great mass of people because you want to find out something about them. You want to find out what you can tell them and how you can get them to do things. It's not just the government. In fact, the government's actually the safest group of people that spy on you. Worry a lot more about big corporations and worry a lot more about big politicians. You are data mined every single day by multinational corporations, and they sell that data to other corporations and to politicians, and politicians use that information to figure out what your weak points are, how they can manipulate you, how they can narrow the discourse into a fear-based conversation that will cause you to do things. That's why people gather information on you. Again, if you were interesting enough to spy on, fabulous. But the fact of the matter, not that I legitimize it, but I'm saying, at least you'd be interesting. But the fact of the matter is, we should be far more concerned because, of course, when we know we are spied on and when our discussion is manipulated, what happens? We are less inclined to communicate. We are less inclined to speak up. We grow quieter. And so in a moment where our free press stands down and doesn't ask tough questions because George Bush will tell us that's not how we do it in America, when we are afraid to speak up because what we say may be monitored, while our information may be gathered, and when we do give information, when it is turned back on us to cause us to vote in certain ways or to manipulate our fears, We grow quieter. We grow softer. It becomes easier to facilitate rather than clog the rush to war. It's the simplest. These are not hard concepts. There's nothing complicated going on here. What then do we do if we are sitting in this wonderful room in Chicago, Illinois, thinking that perhaps before we finish the night, we will be involved in another war, and that that war will be undeclared in violation of, in conflict with our Constitution? How do we as citizens react to that? What do? You oppose the war. You march, you write, you campaign, you thank Congressman Jan Schakowsky for signing a letter demanding that Congress hold a vote on whether we go to war. And you ask every other member why they haven't signed on yet. But don't stop there. At some point, we have to look up from the moment and recognize the crisis. The great biblical texts of all of our religions go back to a couple of questions. Question and answer, really. If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? You find that in Psalms a little bit later. The stone which the builders rejected is now the headstone at the corner. That which was rejected, that which was destroyed, was picked up and made into something. We, the people of the United States, need to take that which has been rejected and rebuild it and make it into something. The founders, as Heidi and Bob have pointed out with Madison, as I hope I have with George Mason, intended that their Constitution would clog rather than facilitate the rush to war. The Constitution itself is a strong document. It is a valid document, but it is no longer respected and it is no longer used. And the tools it gives us, a free press and the freedom to communicate, have been undermined dramatically. That First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment, dramatically undermined. Let us get serious about the rebuilding of it. Let's not talk so much about whether we like Edward Snowden or whether who we like or who we don't like. Let's talk about what we have learned. And let's talk about what that means to us. But let's also do something else as we look up. Not narrowly down, a little bit afraid, but strongly standing as Americans. Let us look up and say, it is time to rebuild and extend that Constitution. It is absolutely absurd that the munitions merchants that George Norris and Robert M. La Follette called out almost 100 years ago can now spend whatever they want on campaigns. That Constitution must be amended to include an absolute ban on corporate money. Corporations are not people. Money is not speech. And this relates to questions of war and peace, because if you can be manipulated in your politics, you cannot be free. But let us also amend that Constitution in one other way. When the great philosopher George Bush was defeated for president, in 2000, he and his allies manipulated his way into the office. He lost the popular vote, and yet the Supreme Court made it possible for him to become president of the United States. And during that session, there was a great debate on the court. Somebody got up and said, well, the right to vote is being denied. It's being disrespected. Antonin Scalia said, you have no right to vote in presidential elections. And Antonin Scalia is absolutely right. There has never been a right to vote. Imagine the disregard for the citizenry. Imagine the disrespect for the citizenry. Let's take a look at our Constitution once more. Let's renew the parts of it that have been weakened. But let us also assert ourselves and say, well, I would love to have a new Voting Rights Act. I want in my Constitution an absolutely guaranteed right to vote and a right to have that vote counted. And brothers and sisters, I want a free press strong enough to tell us if we are being led into war. I want a freedom to communicate rich enough and bold enough so that we can tell one another that that war should not be fought. And brothers and sisters, if someone leads us into an illegal and immoral war, I want the power of the vote to remove those who have led us into that war and to replace them with those who will understand the necessity of peace and economic justice. Thank you very much.
That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. If you'd like to learn more and get involved in making media, including how to help make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org. I'm Bree Hayden. Special thanks to Dale Lehman for audio assistance. Thank you for listening, and please join us again for another episode, From the Trenches.